Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks, on this Aloha Friday, August 8th. A number of events are taking place on Maui as we mark 2 years since the wildfires. We reflect on our recovery and consider the long road ahead to make our community whole again, from our economy to our spirits and well-being. We check in with small businesses to see how they've fared. We hear from a chocolate company we've been tracking since the blaze. And we talk to a coffee farmer who's preparing for a coffee festival this weekend. We get an update from the largest study of fire survivors that Hawaii has ever seen. Plus, we hear reflections from a pilot who recalls the days after the disaster and how a community pulled together to help those in need.
I am moving to the island of the valley, to Lahaina, Lahaina Luna, where the mountains are green, you will find me.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Maui residents are gathering at Hanaka'o'o Beach Park to honor the 102 lives lost and to mark 2 years since the Maui wildfires. A paddle out began at 7 a.m. with events planned throughout the day, ending with a memorial service at the Lahaina Civic Center Amphitheater. HPR's Maui Nui reporter Catherine Kluet-Pachtel has been on the scene as a helicopter dropped flower petals into the water and speakers reflected on the day. Courtney Lazo from Lahaina Strong spoke about the importance of showing up for one another and creating spaces to gather and heal. West Maui County Councilmember Tamara Palton said this to the crowd.
I hope you're enjoying everything that the county has provided for you. We really wanted to make sure that nobody felt alone today or any day. We know that every day is a struggle, some days more, some days less. But the main thing is, you can cry, you can give up, but the next day you just gotta wake up and go again, and that's what we are. And this whole thing is a horrible thing that happened, but already I see that the feeling that people are making with each other, with their aima, it's getting stronger. And just know that we won't ever stop fighting for you folks and working hard for you. So please, today of all of these, don't be alone. We have a thing at the county building right after this. We're something at the Civic tonight, tomorrow, the bone dance. So this weekend, really just take the time to reflect. We've come a long way, we still got longer to go, and we'll get there together. Mahalo.
That was Maui County Council Member Tamara Palton addressing a crowd this morning. We also spoke with Catherine Kluet-Pachtel about what's in store for the rest of the day.
So folks are gathering at the county building in Wailuku around noon today. There will be officials speaking about the two-year mark. And then in the evening, tonight at 5:30 p.m., there is a tribute and memorial for the lives that were lost in the fire. That's happening at Lahaina Civic Center.
Yes, we did talk to a number of the churches there in Lahaina, and Maria Lanakila, I think, has a service, a mass at 6 o'clock this evening as well. And I believe tomorrow is the Lahaina Obon dance, where they'll be remembering the people who we've lost.
And it's also good to remember that families and friends, will be observing the day in their own way in many cases. Community gatherings might not be for everybody, so folks might be getting together with loved ones, visiting their burned home sites in Lahaina, spending time outdoors, whatever feels right to them to remember this day.
And it's really more than just this day, right? I mean, all week we've been just reflecting back on how far we've come.
Absolutely. Recovery is very much a work in progress, as we've been looking at this week, both physically and emotionally for fire survivors. Only 45 homes of the more than 2,000 burned structures in Lahaina have been completed up until this point. Hundreds more have been issued permits by Maui County and are in various stages of progress. But looking at the numbers, we have the results of a recent University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization study that just came in this week. They looked at monthly survey data for more than 950 fire-affected folks over the past year. You know, it's important to remember that numbers don't always tell the whole story of what's happening on the ground in the community, but they do kind of give us an overview of, again, those numbers and trends. UHERO economist Daniela Bond-Smith talks about takeaways from the study and how recovery looks by the numbers.
More than half of fire-affected households now live in permanent housing. And of those who still remain in temporary housing, nearly half have lived in the same home for more than a year. And also the share of people in precarious housing conditions, such as living with family and friends or being unhoused, has halved over the last year. So there has been important progress in transitioning from temporary to more permanent housing, even though this process is obviously far from complete. The rental market is somewhat stabilizing, especially for smaller units, where we've seen a drop in median rent over the last year, whereas rents for larger units of three or more bedrooms have been more persistent. Without a sustained increase in housing supply, these pressures will only worsen over time, especially if FEMA rental assistance expires in 2026 as planned. In terms of the economic recovery beyond housing, this has been more protracted. Full-time employment is still well below pre-disaster levels. Underemployment is common, and unemployment among fire-affected individuals sits around 8%, which compares to about 3% island-wide. Almost 60% of fire-affected households report lower incomes than before the fires, and the share of households living in poverty has also nearly doubled. What we're really seeing is these sort of divergent pathways of some people who have been able to recover, you know, a sense of stability in their lives across housing, across employment, their income, etc. So there are these success stories. People have been able to bounce back. And on the other hand, we have a substantial number of the fire-affected population who still face those challenges. So it's really, it's a story of those sort of two pathways happening side by side.
Yes, and housing and jobs, so important for the stability of a community.
Absolutely, and people are still spread out in that housing all over the island. And, you know, as we know, many folks have had to move off Maui. And so really just that sense of community isn't there yet for folks. And that's the hope for the future, is that people, as they move back to Lahaina, will be able to feel that community that they miss so much once again. You know, driving through Lahaina, as Bond-Smith talked about, various stages of different pathways, neighborhoods are in a lot of different stages of construction. 45 homes have already been completed. A lot of homes are somewhere in the middle, may have walls up, roof still in the works. And some former house sites are still gravel, you know, after the debris removal. Construction hasn't started there yet. And that really reflects those different stages of recovery where people are, depending on their financial circumstances. Some people start building and realize, you know, they just don't have the funds to finish at this point. And other folks just aren't ready mentally to navigate that really daunting process. It's also a matter of rebuilding rental, you know, larger rental accommodations in Lahaina, which, you know, certainly isn't there yet. You know, Front Street is mostly closed still. The majority of the street is blocked off. Entry is not allowed. It's really, you know, unsafe area still. But the edges of the harbor are open. So, you know, I was there the other day and there was a keiki surf meet happening, you know, right there in the harbor. You know, the kids were playing in the water. And then right next to that, you know, are just completely decimated buildings, you know, maybe some foundations left over. You know, you talked about the Lahaina Restoration Foundation doing a lot of work in that area. There are historic buildings. They're working on shoring those up. But it's really just almost unrecognizable. You know, the landmarks that we're so used to seeing in Lahaina, you know, the Pioneer Inn and so many of the businesses, you know, it's almost hard to get your bearings because those aren't there anymore. And of course, the debris transfer process from the temporary site in Uluwalu to the permanent site at the Central Maui Landfill is ongoing. That will be happening through the end of the year. They're about halfway done at this point. A steady stream of trucks carrying that fire debris to the Central Maui Landfill. And we don't want to forget Kula, too. You know, we focused a lot on Lahaina, but folks in Kula are slowly working on rebuilding. More than 20 homes burned there, and 4 houses have been rebuilt at this point.
You also mentioned the people who have moved away, and we, you know, hope that they're doing well wherever they're at and that they can return someday soon.
Absolutely. Different process for everybody.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HBR's Catherine Kuapaktal. You can find our Maui coverage on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. While Lahaina residents still struggle with housing, the business community is facing its own challenges. None of the commercial structures on Front Street have been rebuilt, and just 33 of 174 non-residential permit applications have been approved. A few months after the Lahaina fires, we carried a live broadcast from the Maui Kuia Estate Chocolate Factory in Lahaina. Remarkably, the factory did not burn down, despite the fact that structures only yards away were completely destroyed. We've been sharing the company's story from pre-fires to post. Kuia continues to win awards for its chocolate and expanded its operations with factory tours, but its owner says it's only bringing in a fraction of the revenue that it earned before the fires. The conversations G.W. Gibson recently visited with the CEO of the company, Gunners Volkers. He was working a Sunday shift on the factory floor.
I heard you're here 7 days a week.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
If I ever have a day at home, it's Saturday. That's my computer day,
yeah.
Which I'm basically on computer 10 hours Saturday. So that's my off day.
So I just finished making chocolate. I'm transferring it from one machine to another. So the sort of the whirring and noise you'll hear in the background is the machine in the other room, which is louder. And it's pumping chocolate through this heated pipe that's going through the wall into this machine. So that's got about 150 kilograms of chocolate in it. I'm transferring one load. I have to check on that because it looks like it might be done transferring. I don't see anything coming out. And when it's done, then I'll have to add a little bit of extra butter, cocoa butter, to flush it out. This is Maui dark chocolate. So it was entirely grown on our farm, which is about a mile and a half away. We're very unique in that we make chocolate from cacao that we grow. We also have other sources around the world that are among the best in the world. We've won some major international awards, awards called the Cocoa of Excellence. It's a grower competition. We've won it twice. Like, they didn't let me in the competition this year because I've won it twice. They opened and went 3 times. They said, no, you can't enter because you've won it twice. So
let's go in here where it's quieter, okay?
How are things with the farm and the business these days?
Well, things have not recovered, obviously, since the fire. It's not that the fire damaged this property. It didn't. But it did damage the economy on the west side of Maui. And people, you know, initially for about a year were told, don't go there. I mean, literally, don't go to Lahaina. Well, we're sitting in Lahaina right now, right? So when they're saying, don't go to Lahaina, they're saying, don't go to my business. So that was very difficult, and we lost a lot of money in the first year after the fire. And slowly, I think people have started coming back. I think the message has changed. I think it's more positive, like, please come back to Maui now. We're ready to receive you. And I think that's good, but it's, you know, there was a lot of damage done. And it's still not anywhere close to normal. So we're still seeing revenues well below what we saw before the fire. And we've seen a number of people, you know, coming in much lower, too. Now, we may benefit a little bit because there's not a whole lot to do on this side of the island, you know, so there are people really looking for activities and they're finding us. But still, relatively speaking, it's still substantially below what it was before the fire. So, yeah, we're recovering, but it's not as fast as I like or that anybody would like.
And I saw images that a colleague of mine took from your parking structure just about a year or so ago, year and a half ago, I think. And it was remarkable. It was a bunch of burned out vehicles across the street. So maybe if for listeners who aren't familiar with the immediate area, if you could maybe even just walk us through the last couple of years in terms of what you see.
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing that happened was there was a four-story, 80-unit apartment complex directly across the street from the parking lot of our factory. I mean, 50 yards away, and it burned to the foundation. I mean, they're reconstructing it now. It's not finished yet. I mean, but you can see the building, and you can see that it's, you know, under construction. They're mostly working on the interior now. I think pretty much the exterior is done. But, I mean, that was, you know, 300 people were living in there, and they got displaced, and they're all over the island. I don't know, really don't know where they are. I imagine they have the right to come back when it's ready, because that was affordable housing. Anytime you lose housing is bad, but we were really short of affordable housing before the fire, and it just got so much worse afterwards.
Yeah, and so much conversation about housing. I know we've been covering it a lot, and it's foremost on the mind, because if you don't have housing, nothing can build out from there. That's the sort of the center post. That said, I think we sometimes don't have as many conversations about what the local economy looks like around here, what the business community looks like around here. You spoke to some of the struggles you've had the last couple of years, but maybe talk about what efforts you see, if any, or what efforts you'd like to see locally to help encourage the business community, the commercial streets, to come back. Where is it now, and where would you like it to see it go?
Well, I think that I know there's a lot of things going on with the Hawaii Tourism Authority and all that, so I don't really know the politics of that. But the county government needs to be, I think, a little more encouraging of local businesses. I don't know exactly what they can do in terms of promotion, but the message definitely needs to be that people should be coming back to the west side of Maui. There are hotels that I don't think they're full, but, you know, after the fire, there were housing displaced people. They were getting full market rates for about a year. You know, they were actually doing pretty well, because they were fully occupied, at least the ones that were housing displaced people. And then all of a sudden that had to shift back to the visitor economy. And I don't know how well they've been doing in terms of that shifting. They've got a whole lot more resources than I do, right? I mean, they're backed by large companies. So I don't have the same resources to survive that kind of transition. So we are transitioning to a better place, but it's not better yet. Well, it's better than it was, but it's not as good as it was before the fire. Let me put it that way.
How far off do you feel like you are from where you were before the fire?
Revenue-wise, I would say that we're about 75% of what we were. And I've actually had to do all sorts of different things I never did before. I've started something I call the factory experience, where I take people into the factory, you know, give them an hour-long experience, you know, discuss how we make chocolate and give them samples along the way. And that's been very successful, and it's bridged the gap a bit, but it's not quite there yet. So I'm still losing money, is the point. I've been losing money for 2 years. So it's a little difficult to stomach that. And I didn't have a lot of reserve because of COVID to begin with, right? COVID was a two-year fiasco afterwards, because the state shut down for 8 months, and then it took a long time for people to get comfortable with traveling again. When they were, they started coming back, and things were looking pretty good in 2023. And then, you know what happened on August 8th. Everything crumbled back into pretty much nothing again.
Those are a lot of hard facts you just went through, even taking us back to COVID and that sort of double whammy of that pandemic and then the fires. All of those facts, how do you feel about all of that? How are you holding up?
Not well. I mean, that's just flat out saying that I'm not doing well. I've been working 70 hours a week for 5 years, and I'm 73 years old, right? So would you do well under those circumstances? Well, I'm not doing well either.
What, is there anything that you would like to see from the community, anything that could help you and your colleagues in the predicament that you're in?
Yeah, come to the factory and buy chocolate. I think that's it, right? I'm not asking for a handout. I just want more people coming in the door and buying chocolate. And if they don't know we're here, I mean, it's sort of amazing that local people would not know we're here, because we support the community through a number of different nonprofit giveaways that we have. Like, just after I'm talking to you, I'm going to be doing a tour for 10. It's for the benefit of nonprofits, and it's going to be $1,250, and I'm giving away all the ticket proceeds. I do that every Sunday, right? It's just part of my kuleana. So I feel, you know, that's why this company was established, really, to give back to the community. So I'm doing it, but, you know, sometimes it feels to me like the community is not giving back to me.
Tell me a little bit about your staff and how they're doing, because I know everyone is affected in different ways, housing issues. How has it been trying to keep this place staffed, and the people that work for you, how are they doing?
it's been difficult. I mean, staff had a huge turnover after the fire. Many people didn't come back. Some that did now live on the other side. So they're commuting more than an hour each way because the traffic is really bad during the morning and the afternoon hours when they have to go back and forth. So unless they start their day really early, like, you know, 6:30 or 7, they're sort of stuck in traffic both ways. So it can take an hour and a half each way for them. So I do have people that did come back, but I also have a lot of new people that are more local. They're living in the west side. For them, the traffic isn't a big deal. But some of my key people had to move to the other side because they lost their residences. Whether they rented them or owned them, they're gone, right? So they had to make that move, and they decided they still wanted to work here. So they do come back, but it's not easy for them, I'm sure. And who wants to commute 3 hours a day? You know, it's really just the recovery of Lahaina. I mean, ultimately, you know, everybody thinks Lahaina will again be a draw and draw people to this side, but that's 5 years to 10 years away. To the point where people will actually want to go downtown, I think it's more like 10 years. So we have to survive somehow in the interim. So I'm not counting on that bringing people back. I think that what has to be done is people have to come back because there are things to do here. They need to know about those things. They need to know that these businesses are suffering because the visitor and resident traffic isn't what it used to be. And, you know, we need their help.
That was Kuia Maui Estate Chocolate founder Gunners Volkers and HPR's G.W. Gibson reflecting on the slow recovery for businesses 2 years after the fires. From chocolate, we turn our attention to coffee. This weekend, the Maui Coffee Association holds its Seed to Cup Coffee Festival. The event is on Sunday at the Maui Tropical Plantation in Waikapu. Jerry Ross is a small coffee grower and past president of the association. We wondered about how the local coffee industry might be affected with the new tariffs that have kicked in this week. Ross shares that Maui's largest coffee company was hit hard by the fires and is still struggling to get back on track.
Maui Grown, which is based in Ka'anapali, just up the street from the chocolate guys, they lost their entire stockpile, their entire harvest from the previous year in the fires. Their warehouse was pretty much right in downtown Lahaina, close to Lahaina Luna Road.
Oh, that's terrible.
So they lost all that coffee, plus a lot of their equipment got burned. They weren't able to rebuild right away because FEMA ended up using the big concrete pad for their processing plant for a staging area. So they had to go through lots of gymnastics to try to get things, a new processing facility put up. And they're still waiting for permits, and construction really hasn't begun, and it's driving them crazy. I think last year they had to pick and bury all of the coffee because of insurance. So their coffee is all mechanically harvested. So they just went through, mechanically harvested everything, and then they had to bury it. They couldn't sell it. They couldn't have people come and hand pick it because of insurance. The largest coffee producer on the island has really been negatively impacted by the fires for going on more than 2 years now.
Oh, my gosh. I guess we didn't realize the depth of the losses. So I imagine it's just going to be very difficult to rebound.
The coffee farm itself was not impacted. It was just the processing facility, which is where you take the coffee cherries, they get sorted for different levels of ripeness, they get processed, the hulls are removed, you do flotation to get rid of the poor quality ones, you do a fermentation, drying, all this sort of stuff. It's a pretty big deal when you're looking at a couple million pounds of coffee. So all that equipment was toast. And so they've got to rebuild all of that. And it's just a lot of things going on in Lahaina. The permitting processes have been very slow, which I think have been impeding recovery, unnecessarily slow in my opinion. But I'm not working for the county, so I don't really know for sure.
With the coffee trees then still viable, that's hopeful then?
Yes. Yes, and I think it's frustrating for the president of the company, Kimo Falconer, because he's got these beautiful coffee trees. They have 400 acres, I think. but they can't process them because they don't have the equipment. And so they just have to bury their crop because of insurance requirements. So they're hoping that this year they'll be able to actually process things. It's just another unfortunate casualty of the Lahaina fires.
And then with the added stress of the tariffs, when I don't know, we've been hearing that, oh, the folks that, you know, blend their coffee with beans from other places, if it comes from Brazil, then that's another cost because those tariffs are very high. But how are you looking at that?
Personally, it doesn't affect us. We're a pretty small farm. We do basically seed to cup is the way that we go because as a small farm, the closer you can get your product, whether it's carrots, coffee, or mangoes, the closer you can get that to the consumer, the better your margins are. So we don't do blending. We don't sell green beans wholesale. We only sell roasted coffee. And when we're at farmers markets, we would take it all the way to the end. We would have brewed coffee that we would sell at farmers markets, but we don't do that anymore.
And how are you just looking at the tariffs in general for the global coffee industry?
I think they're very misdirected, personally. Don't really see why putting a tariff on a country that grows coffee when the Hawaiian coffee is a fraction of a percent of the global coffee. I don't see what the value of that is. I go back to the Smoot-Hawley Act in 1930, which was the first time that tariffs were introduced at this scale. And the result of that is agreed by many economists. It was widely agreed that it was a very poor and a very poor move on behalf of the government, and it resulted in increased hardship for American consumers. And at least most economists say it really isn't a good idea to repeat that, but we have an administration that seems hell-bent on that.
I know as a coffee drinker, I'm worried too about the price of a cup of joe, whether it's a nice locally grown cup of coffee or from offshore. But yeah, all these concerns about the prices of everything going up, it's a worry.
I understand. And one of the things that just passed in the legislature this year is a labeling law. So previously, you could sell coffee anywhere in the world from Hawaii that would only be, say, 10% Kona and 90% Sumatran or Brazilian or whatever. And legislation was passed in the ledge this year to make it so that it has to be 51% Kona coffee. You can't be diluting the name literally with Sumatran or Brazilian or whatever. And so I think that works to the benefit of coffee growers. It may not work to the benefit of blenders, but 10% Kona at an ABC store is probably a thing of the past moving forward.
Okay. And gosh, this weekend you folks are holding your coffee festival. Talk about how long that's been going on.
Oh, I was trying to recount. It's something like 17 years. It started out at the Kula Community Center in upcountry Maui, where it was mostly farmers and a few coffee roasters, backyard roasters, and it was a mom and pop kind of thing where we would get together and compare notes about how we're growing, processing, and roasting coffee, even if you're roasting coffee on your barbecue. And then it started to morph into a larger event, moving to the college campus here, and then eventually finding a permanent home at Maui Tropical Plantation. And now it's become a really big deal with 2,000 to 3,000 people a year. We have a barista throwdown. We have Taste the Roast. We have farmers selling coffee. There's all kinds of food. There's workshops. So our core mission is still educating people both from the consumer to the farmer about what makes a cup of coffee better. And we haven't lost sight of that. And for example, now we're including a lot more of the roasting community with Taste the Roast, and you get the opportunity as a consumer to participate in that. You get to taste each of the coffees, vote on which one you like the most. The roasters are there, and they tell you why they chose which roast they did. So it's lots of feedback between the consumer and the roaster with a single batch of green coffee beans.
And that was Jerry Ross, a small coffee farmer and past president of the Maui Coffee Association. And for you coffee connoisseurs out there, we will have links to the Seed to Cup Coffee Festival on our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Hawaii Public Radio has been recognized with 8 Excellence in Journalism Awards from the Society of Professional Journalists Hawaii Chapter, including Best Overall News Site. HPR is committed to serving the people of Hawaii, on air and online, wherever you are. View the full list of HPR's winning stories at hawaiipublicradio.org/awards.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
The Maui Wildfire Exposure Cohort Study is the largest of its kind in state history. Since it launched in January 2024, University of Hawaii researchers have tracked the physical and mental health of more than 2,000 adults and children. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with the lead of that study, Alika Mauna Kea, about new results from the research. Half of fire survivors in the study showed signs of depression, and nearly a quarter had poor lung function now years after the fires.
What are you thinking about 2 years post-fire?
Well, mahalo for the opportunity for us to share our perspectives and our reflections from the aftermath of the disaster and in this particular period, the solemn anniversary of the fires. I think the main thing that, you know, we're seeing from our participants in the study that we've recruited over the past few years now are some visible signs of stress that remain, but also some emerging factors of resilience starting to play out in the community. So sure signs of recovery, but slow, of course, as you would expect.
You've been putting out publications, research papers on a regular basis since this study started. Tell us about some of the recent research that you've had come out.
We've learned a lot from this cohort study over the past 2 years, and we're still learning a lot as we understand the issue and as some of the signs of health and recovery and resilience start to emerge in that community. So we're still a lot more to discover. If I could just tell you one thing that emerged as a result from our community partnerships and from collecting this information is that disasters don't affect everyone equally. Our data show that social, economic, and even environmental factors can intersect with ethnicity and gender, and that's something that we need to address head-on in our recovery and health planning. For example, culturally grounded mental health resources, language access, and community-specific interventions. And this cohort, which is very diverse, and actually one of the most diverse cohorts following a natural disaster that I think exists in the U.S. right now, really helped us to understand where the needs are greatest and how it affects people differently. And so one of the challenges for us is to better understand that. And in doing so, we are trying to analyze multi-levels of information, multi-layered data that include social, economics, food security, health information from participants in their self-report, but also integrate that with some of the lived experiences, their health screenings at the time that we provide the screenings upon enrollment, some of the biospecimens that we collect. For example, we're screening for heavy metals and other types of chemical exposures that they might have been exposed to, and even during recovery, trying to understand how that might affect risk for developing certain chronic conditions and how that might be mitigated. As this plays out, we're learning more and more. And one of the first reports we're happy to finally release as part of the 2-year anniversary from the fires are explaining sort of the broad health effects of wildfire exposures in this large community cohort, which has never been done before. And it builds on our initial data, the Maui West data, and affirms many of the patterns that we've observed, particularly regarding the cardiovascular, respiratory, and mental health trends that I mentioned. This paper is meant to empower policy, inform recovery funding, as well as to validate what many in the community already expressed. So we're hoping that that paper with some of the implications from the study can be shared more broadly, and we'll be inviting the public to a session where we'll explain the implications in a more accessible community-centered language. So in that paper, we describe not only the issues that we see, these consequences of the wildfires, including the social disruption, the mental health challenges, as well as the increased risk of cardiovascular and cardiopulmonary conditions that are emerging in adults in particular. We also starting to see this in children. That's what we're reporting. And we're also finding not only that there are these trends emerging as a result of the aftermath of the fires, and they're actually directly linked because we have a comparator population that's unexposed to compare sort of our baseline to. So we know that a lot of the challenges in health in particular that our community still faces emerges as a direct result and consequence of being exposed to the fires. And so what we're learning also is that certain resilience factors are also playing out in the course of recovery. So for example, individuals that have strong social support, and that could be support from individuals in the community, their neighbors, from community-based organizations that provide food and aid in other ways, some of the federal support as well. For those that receive these types of social support tend to have better health outcomes. And those that actually express that stronger social support seem to be at lower risk for developing these chronic conditions. And we've seen this already emerge in our initial cohort of individuals that have been enrolled in the study very early on, from 6 to 18 months after the fires. And then we just finished a round of follow-up for those individuals, so about a year out. And so we can tell that there are some of these signs emerging. Those that have a stronger support socially tend to have less risk for these chronic conditions that are emerging in the predominant cohort. So there are some signs of strengths there that I think we can leverage to enhance some of the interventions that need to be in place in order to have a broad benefit for the community.
Yeah, but I think it is important to note when talking about resiliency and involvement in like social support networks that the effect seems to mainly be on psychological outcomes rather than something
that's
like
true.
Lung function.
That's true, and that's something that we actually highlighted in the paper, that although it does seem to protect some of the mental health challenges that people are experiencing as a result of being exposed to the fires, it doesn't eliminate the risk for some of the physiological health challenges, including pulmonary conditions that are emerging. And so that's something that we are really trying to better understand, the association between the two. We do think that there is an interplay between some of the mental health issues and some of the physiological signs. So individuals who are less able to cope because they have lower social support for some of these mental health challenges that could increase their risk for some of these physiological conditions that we're seeing emerge. And so we're trying to understand how we can use that information to better intervene to reduce that risk and to see actually within our own cohort, those individuals, if they're utilizing and there's increased uptake of care, especially those that are already going through this period of trauma and, you know, and high risk of PTSD and being looked after, whether or not that actually does have a positive benefit to their physiological outlook. And so that's a big question that we're still following through in this cohort.
What other questions are you looking at moving forward?
One of the biggest ones actually comes to environmental hazards, and something that we are really concerned about, because just as what we've witnessed in California with the LA wildfires, there's a lot of toxins involved, and that's mobilized as a result of the fires. For example, heavy metals that have been implicated already in health conditions in individuals that have been affected by the fires. And we have data that's emerging that's showing that individuals who have been exposed more directly and have actually self-reported being exposed more frequently to the ash and the dust in the aftermath of the fires tended to have a higher risk for these poor health outcomes that I mentioned, such as increased cardiovascular risk as well as pulmonary conditions. And we also think that those individuals might actually be exposed to these chemical hazards that then might lead towards those conditions. And so we're trying to disentangle that effect. And what's really particularly worrisome right now is that, as you know, Hawaii has a history of industrial agriculture, right? Maui is one of the main centers of that industrial age back in our history, where there was a lot of plantations, sugarcane plantations and others. And we know that left behind in that environment, the fertilizer and the pesticides that were used are for chemicals as well as these heavy metals that could have been mobilized as a result of the wildfires. And people might have been exposed to them either directly or indirectly as initially they experienced 2 years ago during the fires, or even during the recovery process afterwards, returning to places that might still have some trace amounts of these hazards that they might interact with or be exposed to. So that's an ongoing concern that we have. And it's not just our concern scientifically, but we're also getting this concern from our community. And so the idea of that following up this cohort longitudinally over time is really critical, because there's things that we expect to change as the recovery happens, and encountering additional exposures from potential contaminants that are remaining left behind could still play a role in some of the health issues. And so that's a big question that remains unaddressed, and we're hoping that this cohort study will be a part of the answer, is trying to understand that potential issue, which would have broader implications beyond just the community and individuals impacted by the fires themselves.
Looking forward, thinking about following up with this cohort over the span of years, particularly as some of the chronic conditions that you're interested in take years to manifest, a study like that takes money.
Yes.
So what does the funding picture look like?
Well, funding has always been challenging, even before the changes in federal policy on some of the grants that you're seeing play out right now. And so, you know, we are challenged by that even more now than ever. I think we are really trying to strengthen our ties with our community partners and leverage some of the support on the ground, because they know best what our community needs, and they can help us with addressing some of those issues while we're also trying to collect information on understanding where the needs are greatest and how we can actually resolve them in a more meaningful way, you know, using resources intelligently, using the data to help us drive the solution so that we can actually implement efficient policies that could actually help people at the same time, reducing cost and help us to understand the problems long term. So that's some of the things that we're trying to work on, is a shift in understanding that, you know, a lot of the research that we're doing on the ground can be blended with sort of health services and wraparound support that individuals need, at the same time can also provide us with information to learn about the situation in as part of the study. So we tend to leverage our research with working with our community partners in this manner. And I think that's the key, I think, ingredient that will help us sustain our efforts, yeah, despite a lot of the federal challenges in funding.
Yeah. So looking inward rather than outward.
Yes, I think that makes sense for us. I mean, we actually started on shoestring budget when we started this study in the first place. And I think that's the solution to rely on to help us sustain it. As long as we can provide a benefit to both the individuals that have been really suffering from the aftermath of the disaster and been displaced several times as part of it and recovering, as well as the larger community around them, that I think we can all work together on addressing those greater needs. Because I think even those impacts like exposure and links to health, some of the social challenges, don't just affect the people that are surviving the fires. It's also affecting everybody around them as well. And so I think that's one potential route for sustained support, is working with our community partners that are already engaging in providing this kinds of social support in different ways, and working with the community and helping it to tie in better to health, to strengthen that dimension better, so that we can improve the health of the community that has been affected by the fires, but also those around them throughout the state.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you very much for having me, Mahalo.
That was University of Hawaii Medical School researcher Alika Monakea. He spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about recent results from the Maui Wildfire Exposure Cohort Study. To find out more, check our website after the show. Close our show today, we hear from a pilot. Ellen Massey recalls a mission that was born out of necessity. The Lahaina airlift was about bringing much-needed goods to needy families. Massey was a fairly new pilot at the controls. She'd been flying for about a year. We talked to her recently about her memories of those early days immediately after the fire.
It was shocking to fly over Lahaina. I knew what had happened, obviously. I mean, that's why I was there. That's why I was delivering supplies, and we all knew what had happened, but seeing it right off my wingtip there and still smoking a little bit and all the rubble, it looked It honestly looked like scenes I've seen of towns that have been bombed. It was obviously utterly destroyed, and I wasn't prepared for that at all. I don't think anybody was, and it was very emotional. I had a really hard time with it and had to really focus on what I was doing and not let that interfere with what I was doing, because what I was doing was difficult and beyond the capabilities of the small plane I was flying in the winds immediately following the fire. But yeah, that was a tough moment for sure. And it continued to be hard hearing the stories of the firemen and locals there, volunteers. And there's some harrowing stories that came through, and it was certainly it was a tough time for sure for everyone. And I didn't even have family or friends who were affected by it directly, but I got to know people there who were, and it was harrowing.
You shared that you were a fairly new pilot, and the mission was a dangerous one. I mean, the winds, which, you know, helped to trigger this inferno, you're dealing with those elements as you're trying to land this little plane. So I just can't even imagine. I'm trying to put myself in your seat at the controls. But yeah, what were you thinking every time you'd fly in and fly out of there?
I was definitely nervous every time I took off, and I knew that it was pushing what I was capable of. I knew I was capable of it, or I wouldn't have done it. But it was, like you say, the winds immediately following the fires that had helped to create them were really strong, and they came accelerating down that mountain slope by Kapalua Airport and getting caught in these various mechanical turbulence, basically in terrain features that like make the wind flow in different directions and make it even harder and more dangerous to bring a tiny, overly loaded airplane into that strip. And yeah, I was a pretty low time pilot. I guess I still am compared to many pilots out there. And it was challenging for sure, but I knew that my decision making was up to it. I knew that if I got there and it was not safe to land, I was not going to. I was not going to have my plane become a problem on the runway and cause more problems for the people I'm trying to help. So I was prepared to not land, as tough as that would be for everybody that I was trying to help out.
Yes, at the end of the day, the reason why you were in this situation is because you saw the great need and you were trying to fill it, right, with the plane and with all the donated supplies to get to those needy families. Because in those early days, FEMA wasn't really organized quite so much so that you could get those pallets of water or whatever it was that the families needed into their hands.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm talking about 2-3 days right after the fires, when all the roads were closed, the disaster relief organizations hadn't galvanized thoroughly or gotten the funding they needed and the boots on the ground. And so we were just looking at local volunteers on Maui and then on the other islands. And it was amazing. The response of people who were donating supplies they donated more supplies than we could carry. And so that was one reason we were flying 3-4 times a day to try and get as much over there as we could. And yeah, I think it was like that for about 12 days before the roads opened and bigger, more capable organizations took over the effort. And there were also boaters who were depositing things on the beach, and they couldn't use the harbor because all the boats in the harbor had burned and clogged up the harbor. It was devastating too, and that's a lot of people's livelihoods right there. But yeah, so there are people landing fuel and water on the beaches, and then we were doing it from the air.
We have talked to so many people who just marvel at the pride of caring. We had such a caring community, and they just stepped up. They didn't need anyone to tell them what to do. It was just, look, it needs to get done. We're going to find a way.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was exactly my experience. I can't remember now exactly how all the pilots on the Big Island figured out that this was something that needed to happen. We knew that the roads were closed. We knew that there was an airport there. And there was a pilot here who first contacted Kapalua and the airport and got permission to fly in. And then it snowballed from there, trying to get more people to do it. And I was one of those. And yeah, I ended up flying every day, 3-4 times a day for 12 days.
So were you in a Cessna or a helicopter? Explain to our listeners.
I was in a four-seat Cessna that weighs about 2,200 pounds, fully loaded. So it has a carrying capacity of, 700 pounds. And that's including the fuel. So we couldn't carry a lot each trip, which is why I was flying more than one trip per day. Yeah, it's a tiny plane. We're talking little trainer from the 1970s.
And you mentioned that the tour operators, right, the helicopter tour companies also pitched in.
Yeah, absolutely. Paradise Helicopters was a big one over here in Big Island that they had a Cessna Caravan at the time, like the same kind of plane that Mokulele flies. And they sent that in, and their helicopters actually carry a lot more than the little Cessna I was flying. So I actually helped them load up and fly over their stuff one time because they're built for scenic tours. And so those bubble windows are not meant for carrying a lot of cargo. But yeah, it all happened safely, and they got a bunch of supplies in there. And I know that other companies did too. I think that Mokulele did. I'm sure that a lot of other ones that I wasn't aware of at the time all helped out. Paradise was the one I was particularly aware of.
I think just that pride and knowing that what you were doing was going to help somebody on the other end.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing how much everybody just put their lives on hold and made this their focus. And I was honored to be part of it and see all my fellow citizens over here on Big Island really doing everything they could to help. It wasn't just the pilots. There were all these people loading and organizing donations and soliciting donations. And there were people putting money into a 501c3 so that we could keep this going. It's expensive to fly small airplanes. And we were really grateful to the people who paid for the fuel and kept us flying. It was an amazing effort.
An amazing effort indeed. That was Ellen Massey, a Big Island pilot who shared her memories of the days following the fatal fires 2 years ago. We hope you've had a chance to hear our coverage of Maui's recovery as we mark 2 years since the fatal fires. You can find links to our stories on our website and on Spotify or Apple.
Big Island of Maui, a very hopeful place for this Hawaiian race. Oluwalu to Napili, we know your family. From the mountain to the sea, Kanaha, Kahoma, and Kauaula, it's our destiny to set the waters free. A message to all, Lahaina, Gomi's.
Well, that does it for us for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to take the show on the road. We will be in downtown Honolulu, 4th Street Mall to be exact, as we explore downtown's future. Live down there, work down there, call or talk back line. Leave us your comments, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Maddie Bender, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. Our intern is Laura Dukes. Our backyard quiz intro written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.